Okay, now, when I decided to make this talk, or to give this talk, I decided to title it The Coming Collapse of America, The Need for Cultural Apologetics, and I wasn't sure if I should put a colon after America or a question mark, okay? Let me give you the reason why I put that question mark, okay? As a, if I'm somewhat of an amateur cultural critic, I would put a period after that, that America is going to collapse, okay? The reason why I put a question mark is we've got a miracle working God, okay? So in other words, what I'm saying is I have like zero hope in the political system. I have... I'm not real thrilled about the state of the Evangelical American Church today. This last talk that Jason Carlson gave, this we've been butting heads with people in this movement since the mid-1990s, but because it was only in the rejection absolute truth stage, nobody was listening. And now all of a sudden we're seeing the fruit of this stuff and how ugly it is. And so it's really, really... unfortunate, the state of the church. So I don't see the church as the conscience of a nation. And so it's kind of like America's without a conscience right now. And we have it in our minds that as long as we change through political means, we change leaders and we change laws, we'll live happily ever after. The only lasting way to change a culture is to change hearts. And there's no better way to change hearts for good than through regeneration. So I am not, what I'm not saying today is that we need to be less politically active. We need to be more politically active. But the priority has to always be evangelism, apologetics, and discipleship. Leading, you want to change your culture? The most powerful thing you can do is lead your neighbor to Christ and then disciple. Get them plugged into a good, solid Bible-believing, Bible-preaching church. But the question mark there is because I don't claim to be a prophet. And we have a God who has done some amazing miracles throughout history. Now, does America deserve a miracle? If I were a betting man, I wouldn't bet on America. I look, search the scriptures. We're not mentioned there, but we look a lot like Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay? So, they didn't get a break. So, whatever the case, the coming collapse of America, the need for cultural apologetics. I'll explain what cultural apologetics is as we go on. Now, could America collapse? Okay, we have politicians both on the left and the right in this country who act like you got to be optimistic. If you're not optimistic, you're part of the problem. Jeremiah was a true prophet. He was not optimistic. Okay, Isaiah wasn't real optimistic about short term. Long term, he's real optimistic. The Messiah is going to come and save the world. You know, he's going to bless the millennial kingdom, not only salvation of individuals, he's going to reign on earth. But in the meantime, Jeremiah is saying you need to, surrender to the Babylonians because God's going to judge you through them. You're past the point of no return. Well, that wasn't a patriotic Jewish message. And so a lot of what we have to understand, we cannot take our patriotism as Americans and make that one of the foundational beliefs of our Christianity. If we do, guess what? We look a lot like the German church right before a man named Adolf Hitler took control. And then it's like, so keep in mind, submitting to the governing authorities, that's important, a biblical command, but our submission to God, when they conflict, Acts 5:29, we must obey God rather than man. I don't even know what this stuff is. Do I hit okay or cancel? Cancel, eh? Okay, I'm sure you guys wouldn't mind if I started updating my computer. Somebody explain why they give me all this stuff when I don't need, this computer doesn't even have internet access. So, believe me, you need to put more faith in me as a cultural critic than for technology purposes. I'm really more squared away in the other area. But does America deserve God's judgment? Look, we're killing babies before they're born. Okay, we're killing babies after they're born. We're committing euthanasia. I thought the Terry Schiavo thing was like you know, the first of its kind. And then, what's the guy's name? Is it, works for the Discovery Institute. He wrote the book, The Culture of Death. And, I don't know if it was J. Wesley Smith or something. I don't remember the guy's name, but whatever the case, no new laws, no changes in laws, and judges all over this country, have been ruling it's okay to unplug Aunt Ethel or whatever. And so since the 1990s, we've been euthanizing people left and right without a change in laws. Just judges playing God. Homosexuality and promiscuity. See, you know, well, I'll get to the next point. But homosexuality, the rise of it, the rise of sexual promiscuity, the rise of violence, idolatry, apostasy within the church. America's report card doesn't look real good right now. Okay? Just read the Bible, read the newspaper, and, you know, if we get a few D's, I'd be happy. That's a good day in America right now. But political correctness, where the debate is already over, and we have these new absolute moral laws, okay? A really good book by William Watkins is entitled The New Absolutes, where he gives you about 10 of the old moral absolutes. See, we went from a stage of God's moral absolutes were respected in this country and upheld to a large degree. Then we went to a moral relativistic stage, where what's right for you is right for you, doesn't have to be right for me, and vice versa. But we're not there anymore. We're in the stage of the new morality. So now it's Isaiah 5:20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. See, in the moral relativist stage, your next-door neighbor said, oh, I'm glad that you're a Christian. If that's good for you, if that works for you, I'm happy, but it doesn't work for me. But now, in the days of new morality, oh, you're a Christian? You're one of those bigots? Okay? So this shift has occurred, and if we do not understand that it's basically going to come back and get us. But there's a new morality and a new tolerance. This is all behind what Jason was talking about, this new view, rejection of absolute truths or watering down of absolute truths, and this new tolerance. This is why Rob Bell had to become a universalist, because his God, to be totally honest with you, his God is the postmodern new tolerance, the idea that every belief is equally true and all behavior is equally wholesome. Oh, by the way, if you disagree with us and condemn somebody, then we can't tolerate you. But he's got this big, mushy tolerance, okay? And he imposes that on God and his interpretation of the scriptures. So in the end, he has to have everybody getting saved. It's just the natural, the logical progression of his thought. Romans 1:32, after listing a whole bunch of sins that happened among the pagans because they rejected belief in God, that final stage was the promotion of evil as if it was something good. Okay? So when homosexuality is on the rise, there's still time for your nation and your culture. But when you have gay pride parades, you're pretty close to God's judgment. Okay? When all of a sudden evil is being promoted as good, things are getting really bad. I've searched the scriptures. I have not found that exemption for the United States of America. Okay? Where thus saith the Lord, America will be standing tall and be the lone superpower when Jesus returns to earth. It's just not there. And I am not a fan of pain. I never liked pain all my life, and I'm not going to start now. My doctor said never have pain enter my body at any time, but it doesn't look good for America. We're trillions of dollars in debt. Do we have hyperinflation to come? Yeah, that's what happened in Germany. They couldn't pay their war debts, so they had hyperinflation headed to the point where, you know, basically a loaf of bread would cost about $20,000. You know, they had to pay people like 3-4 times a day because money was useless. There's a story, I don't know if it's true or not, that there was a wheelbarrow filled with money in Germany under the Weimar Republic when they were going through hyperinflation. And the guy went and put his wheelbarrow filled with money outside the store and went in to look at some stuff in the store, came out, and the money was all over the ground. Somebody had stolen the wheelbarrow. Okay? Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but it's very likely. I mean, you live in a day and age where money is virtually worthless. We have to understand Bonhoeffer, the great theologian and pastor, in Germany. The reason why he was able to keep his ministry afloat so long was his father was a doctor, and a lot of his patients were from countries outside of Germany, and so he asked them to pay him in other currency. It got so bad there. And the recent book by Metaxas on Bonhoeffer, that Bonhoeffer's father had an insurance policy he wanted to cash in because money was becoming worthless. German money was becoming worthless, and he wanted to buy wine and cheese with it. By the time he received it in the mail, he could only get the wine. Okay, and this was a big chunk, thousands of dollars. Now, we might not get hyperinflation. Hyperinflation, by the way, inflation is not when the stores raise the prices. That's a result of inflation. Inflation is when your government inflates the currency. Basically, they print more money. But when you got more dollars chasing the same amount of products, the money becomes worth less, so you have to raise the price of the products. It's an easy way for politicians to tax us without letting us know, and then we get mad at Walmart. Okay? But whatever the case, maybe it won't be hyperinflation. Hyperinflation, like, you know, a dozen eggs might cost $20,000. Mass inflation would be, you know, if a loaf of bread costs $2, it might end up costing $10. Now, you could just figure mass inflation is bad enough, where everything costs 3, 4, 5 times what it costs right now. Okay? Higher gas prices. I mean, this is getting ugly. I mean, you know, there was a day when you went to church, your church had to be walking distance from you, and your job had to be walking distance from you, unless you're wealthy enough to own a horse and buggy. Okay? If we can't afford gas, we're going to have to change our lives drastically. Higher food prices. I mean, if the 18-wheeler's got to pay extra money for the gas to bring the food to the stores, they eventually... they're going to raise their prices, and the stores are going to have to say, well, we can't afford that. We're going to have to raise our prices on the food. By the way, you know, a lot of this, you know, a lot of look at the horrors that are going on in Japan right now. Okay? One thing you have to do, though, is look at the disciplined Japanese people and how they're handling it. They're waiting hour after hour in line for food. If they don't get the food, they might eventually starve to death, and nobody's ditching in line. Then look at the United States of America the day after Thanksgiving. We're willing to kill each other to get the newest video game. Okay? If things get as bad here as they are in Japan for different reasons, do you really think we're going to be as polite as the Japanese are to each other? That's a disciplined culture. We lost our discipline a long time ago. Okay? So we're talking about the possibility of an ugly, ugly future. More military expenses. We feel that America and the American government is morally superior to the rest of the governments of the rest of the world, and you can debate that issue. And so we feel that since we're the lone superpower, it's kind of our job to be kind of the policeman of the world. And we get kind of selective when 1 million people are being slaughtered in Rwanda. We don't intervene. But then something happens in Libya, we intervene. But we've got over 190 different countries. We have well over 1,000 United States military bases. And we're supporting this huge military complex. So I really think that the Republican Party only wants to get, like, you know, 1/10 of the cancer. And the Democratic Party probably doesn't want to get any of the cancer. They want to add a little cancer. But either way, it's kind of like, you know, as long as we have these pet projects that we want to support, you know, if your neighbor needs money and you don't have any money, it's not right for you to just break out the credit card or whatever. If you don't have money, you can't help them. And we continue to make choices both with problems in our country and around the world, acting as if we really have money when we lead the world in debt. And then, of course, on the Democrat side of the aisle, you have the socialist welfare state, and, you know, they don't want to give up on that. You know, so the question comes up, do we really think our elected officials will save us from collapse? I think these three guys are congressmen from New Jersey, and They were working on Obama's health care plan at that time, but I don't know. I'm not real encouraged by the leadership decisions that our political leaders have made. Now, I'm not saying let's do less political activism. I think we need to do more. But I think there's a philosophical foundation. We do our political activism with a knee-jerk reaction where we have no philosophy of government, no biblical philosophy of government, and we don't even understand the Constitution. And then we try to deal with each individual issue. So, I mean, it's not like we're dealing with the trunk of the tree or the branches. We're dealing with individual leaves, and we're not really getting at the root of the problem. So what happens if America collapses? We could have food shortages and starvation, lack of drinking water, looting and violence, especially if you're in the city areas, the populated areas. A lot of people say, oh, wait, what are you, some kind of conspiracy nut or some kind of, wait, this kind of stuff happens to every country eventually all over the globe. But we Americans have had it so good. We've been so prosperous because we're continuing to be blessed because of the faith of our forefathers, a faith that we no longer have, and we think that we're exempt from this. Okay? And, you know, this could happen regionally. You know, we could have Mount Rainier blow, and we're living in this hell on earth. You look at Katrina. Well, all the looting that was going on there. And what did the authorities do? The first thing that when the federal authorities showed up and different police departments that volunteered to go out there and help out, what was the first thing the government did? At a time when there was a lot of looting, when you needed your firearms the most, they went door to door confiscating weapons from law-abiding citizens. Okay? You could have riots and chaos as the infrastructure collapses. You could have a period of chaos and looting, and eventually people beg the government restructures itself, gets a new currency, and then you could have martial law implemented. So you could be the guy, you could be that, get a few of your neighbors, and they're the tough guys, and you guys protected your neighborhood. Great. When martial law is implemented, then they find out who's the bad guy on your block. Because then martial law comes in, they're going to come around door to door, confiscating firearms. There could be a move towards a global currency to say, look, the dollar has crashed. There's people talking about that already. First, they wanted to go with the Emiro. Vicente Fox, the former president of Mexico, admitted that on the Larry King show, where they wanted one currency for Canada, the United States, and Mexico. And this is when the dollar was a lot stronger than it is today. And then nobody was for that. But now they're talking about the dollar being so bad that why not just move towards that global currency right now? And again, move towards a global government, which should be no surprise that people have these kinds of ideas when we read the scriptures. Are you prepared? Let me say this. I'm not a big guy on physical preparation, so I don't feel led to like travel the country saying you need to store non-perishable food. You need to think about what kind of shelter you're going to have during this time period. Are you going to be able to be in your home, or you're going to have to get somewhere else? Is it safe to stay at home? Do you have some kind of water purification? Can you collect rainwater? Can you get well water? Can you take care of the necessities of your families? And by the way, if you can do those four, you're going to probably need firearms to protect it. Because now you've got something everybody else wants. Okay? But I don't even think that's the big emphasis. At the same time, you know, if you tell me you're doing this, what am I going to do? Am I going to say, you're not supposed to be a faithful steward when things get bad? You're only supposed to be a faithful steward when things get good. Right? Even the Egyptians had to gear up during the 7 years of prosperity. So, and you know, some Christians believe we're going to get snatched away before the tribulation. Others think we're going to go through the tribulation. I think it's actually irrelevant when it comes to this. America could take a nosedive 100 years before the tribulation starts. Okay? So basically, as you're feeding your family, maybe go out to eat one time less each year and maybe store up some of that stuff. I think those are important things to do, just being faithful stewards. You know, I've had Christian brothers tell me, no, you're being real carnal because you think that we ought to store up for a rainy day. You just got to trust the Lord. And I had a Christian brother, godly man, but I told him, I said, wait a minute, you're retired. And you're telling me that? And he said, well, yeah, you know. I said, you prepared for your future. I said, with the state of Social Security and the amount of money I got in my retirement, I think I'm on track to retire when I'm like 207 years old or something. You know, it's like this dude is going to be, I'm going to be preaching until the day I die. I have no choice, you know. Forget about being called. I got to eat. And if I get, I think I'm going to have a mega church, though, if I get dementia or something. People are just going to think, well, his sermons are really profound. But you know, we prepare for retirement. But if a guy stores some non-perishable peanut butter, we think, oh, that guy's he's probably a Mormon, closet Mormon or something. So it's like, I'd say this stuff comes down. You know, I'm not as responsible as I need to be. I'm going to be looking for Mormons. I say, hey, you know, I'll talk to you about Jesus if you give me a little bit of peanut butter. Are we prepared emotionally? You know, God has not promised us a rose garden. What does Paul say in 1 Timothy 3? Everyone who desires to live godly will be persecuted. Okay? And we think that just because of America, I got persecuted today. Somebody called me an idiot when I was trying to share Jesus. Wow, that's really, Isaiah, Jewish tradition says Isaiah was sawn in two. But, oh, they called you an idiot. Oh, I really feel bad for you. You know, God didn't promise us a rose garden. We could become like the rest of the world. You know, Ron Carlson was talking about how bad it is for Christians in Islamic countries. It could get that way here. Are we content with the Lord? Because we might become like other nations where all we have is the Lord. Okay? It's not a coincidence that Christianity is in decline. Biblical Christianity is in decline in the West, in the most prosperous nations on earth. And then in the nations, the third world countries where suffering is at its highest point, Christianity, biblical Christianity is growing in leaps and bounds. Okay? Well, praise God, we got a good God. When Ron Carlson was talking about the number, the potential numbers, I think it was him, it might have been Douglas Guyvid, but the potential numbers of Bible-believing Christians in the underground church in China. It's like, you know, Chinese communism declared war on Christianity. And Christianity is winning, you know? But are we prepared spiritually? And I think this is the most important aspect, and this is what I want to focus on. I'm not saying these other things are not important, but I'm saying the most important thing is being spiritually prepared. If we are not willing to live for Jesus when times are good, what makes us think that we're going to be willing to die for him when times get bad? You know? I mean, you know, we don't even pass on our faith to our kids. We teach our kids it's perfectly okay to spend more money on a pair of, you know, get the top of the line basketball sneakers, but then get a tiny print Bible that's, you know, the $7 special or whatever. And we teach them that the Christian life is all about enjoyment and being entertained. And this stuff comes down. Forget about the entertainment, and it's gonna separate the men from the boys. Now, can we prevent the collapse? Only the Lord knows. And in fact, I would say this. I would answer no, we can't prevent the collapse. But God can. Okay? Now, we got to stand up and do the right thing just because it's the right thing to do. Okay? Political action is good. I'm not here to slam political action. But the best way to change a culture, as I said before, is not to change leaders and laws. The best way to change a culture is to change hearts. And the best way to change hearts is through evangelism and discipleship. And that's going to, nowadays in a post-Christian era, if you're going to do evangelism, you're going to share your faith, you got to do apologetics. Okay? Very rarely. Every once in a while it happens. That if you can show somebody anywhere that the Bible says that Jesus is the only way to be saved, they'll accept Jesus. But 99 out of 100 times they're going to ask you, how do you know the Bible's God's word? Or how do you know Jesus actually said that? So, but this idea, and by the way, what's happened because we focus so much on political activism and so little on evangelism, instead of the Christian church, the evangelical church, being the conscience of the nation, or at least the conscience of the Republican Party, we've taken on an attitude, my party, right or wrong. So, you know, if a guy molests little boys and he's got a D at the end of his name, he's a Democrat, we exercise our prophetic voice and we condemn sin and call it what it is. But if the molester has an R at the end of his name, we start talking, our evangelical leaders start talking about what a tough childhood the guy had. Okay? You know, we've got to stop thinking, what's this politically expedient thing to do? We've got to stand up for what is right. So as the Republican Party has gone further and further left, we find the evangelical church going further and further left with them. So the left and the right paradigm, the left and the right are so far left and so much in bed with big government. And what has big government proven in the 20th century? The big government has proven it is the most efficient killing machine in the history of mankind. Killing somewhere between 170 and 300 million of their own people during peacetime in the 20th century alone. Yet, we enter the 21st century almost worshiping the state. And anytime we have a problem, we think the federal government's got to solve this. Instead of thinking about, well, maybe I ought to pray. What is God calling me to do? Maybe I could solve this problem myself. So how can we effectively change hearts? We need to be good apologists to effectively evangelize the lost and disciple the saved. This conference, just spend an hour with Carl Payne. This conference is not about you getting so smart that you can wow people with your brilliance. Okay? This conference is about loving the Lord and loving people and wanting to see them saved. And the fact of the matter is, our culture has become so anti-Christian that if we're going to lead people to Christ, we're going to have to be able to answer their objections. We're going to have to be good apologists. In this post-Christian, politically correct era, we need to be trained not only in just, you know, apologetic defending the essential truths of the faith, but in cultural apologetics as well. In other words, what I'm saying is, even before we do the political activism, we need to defend the biblical concept of government and the biblical concept of morality. Okay? The easy thing for us to do is to think, because an action is a sin, the federal government in Washington, D.C. ought to outlaw it. Okay? That is really dangerous. Okay? God did not institute human government to control every aspect of our lives. God instituted human government to protect our God-given freedom. So it's what the Founding Fathers called the pursuit of happiness. That's the freedom to be all that God called you to be without government interference and without thugs down the block, you know, trying to stomp on you. See, how many people here remember? I know some of you people here are as old as me. How many remember the Rodney King riots? Okay? Remember when they were riding through L.A. and they came to the Korean section? What happened there? They stopped looting. They stopped bringing the Korean, the young males and the older males stood side by side with shotguns and rifles on and looked straight ahead as the rioters were going below them on the streets, and nobody broke anything in the whole Korean section. And I turned to my wife, I said, you know what? Those Korean immigrants are more American than I am. Because they came here not for a handout, they came here for opportunity and freedom. And they worked hard to get what they... And did those elderly, you know, did those elderly guys get wealthy from working hard? No. They're hoping that maybe their son or their grandsons will experience the fruit of their labor. That's what America is supposed to be about. And I'm sure people on the left would say, that is so wrong. Where do they get all those weapons? I think the Korean immigrants understood things could get bad even in America. And America is supposed to respect this thing called the right to bear arms. You're a human being. You got the right to protect yourself. And so basically what I'm saying is before we get involved in political activity, we need to defend the biblical concept of government and morality. I've got a book here, the God, Government, and the Road to Tyranny, Christian View of Government and Morality. We've got a few of them left out on the stand. We're just giving our books away for free. If you want to give us a $5 donation, that's fine. If you don't have the money or you want to use the money to buy Carl Payne's book on the table next to me, fine. Just take the books, okay? Our supporters want us to just get them out there. But this is a step in the right direction. And I didn't write this last week. I think most of the articles were actually written in the 1990s, and I updated them when we published the book in 2003. Okay? But it goes over why we as Christians should believe in small, limited government. Okay? In fact, you know what? The whole idea of government is a biblical idea. Because there's no, government forces people to comply. There's no reason for government unless human life is worth protecting and human life needs protecting. So without the biblical doctrines of creation, we're created in God's image, and the fall, man is sinful, and so we need to be protected from each other. Without those two doctrines, there's no basis for human government. But then once you have human government, guess what? Your leaders are fallen humans. So now you got to limit their power. That's why the Founding Fathers did separation of powers, checks and balances. The Founding Fathers were actually really big on states' rights. Now the states are all just pawns of the federal government. And, you know, right now people think all of the decisions got to be made in Washington, D.C. The day's going to come, they're going to tell us all the decisions need to be made in Rome or Paris or somewhere. Global problems necessitate global solutions. And we hear that mantra over and over again. Can we give reasons for faith? You know, we're commanded to provide people with answers in 1 Peter 3:15. We have to explain to people why are these things wrong. Abortion, infanticide, euthanasia, homosexuality, sexual promiscuity, socialism, big government. Let me tell you, socialism sounds, in a dumbed-down American culture, socialism sounds like, it really sounds like if you're for big government socialism and you want all these big handouts and stuff like that, it really sounds like you care for people. So we got to be able to explain to them, look, if you steal money through taxation from the producers to give to the non-producers, you discourage people from being productive, and everybody eventually becomes non-productive. That's the worst thing you can do for the poor. I mean, you could chart it. The more money we pour into the inner cities, the worse off they get. So if you think you've got a solution and your solution doesn't work, it's a lousy solution, no matter how kind and how gentle it sounds. Things like raising the minimum wage. You know, the only person that helps is the liberal official who got it passed through. He gets reelected. That's all it accomplished. Because you just keep raising an increase in wages without an increase in productivity, it leads to inflation. You just got more phony money chasing the same amount of products. So, we've got to get beyond just the political action. We've got to be smart enough, not just in philosophy and historical evidences for the Christian faith, but also we've got to have a Christian philosophy of government to where we can explain to people why it's right. Okay? Just being American, we don't like to think. It's like when I went to Israel to speak, I thought, I'm the American guy going there to preach in the promised land. Wow, this is going to be cool. And I'm an American. They know I'm smart. And then I found out I was preaching the gospel to people who knew four languages. They were Palestinian Christians. They knew Hebrew. That's the language of the country of Israel. Arabic was their first language. But then they have to read ancient Arabic, a whole different language that they're taught to read the Quran. The culture, they just teach them because most are Muslims. So even the Palestinian Christians could read ancient Arabic, and then they learn English in grammar school and high school. So they got four languages to our one. We Americans tend to be lazy in the learning department, so when we accept Christ as our Savior, it's just like, okay, tell me how I'm supposed to vote. Tell me what issues are good, which ones are bad. We wait for something to come in the mail, and then we just vote that way. And I'm not saying that's bad, but how come we haven't thought through a biblical philosophy of government? So we got to provide biblical, philosophical, medical, cultural, and practical reasons to be effective cultural apologists. For instance, just the medical reasons alone would be enough for us to discourage people from being homosexuals. If we are going to try to discourage people from being smokers because it might take 10 years off their life expectancy, then why not discourage them from being homosexuals when it takes 30 years off their life expectancy? Okay? By the way, I don't think we should, when we take debates on abortion, things like that, I don't think we should automatically throw the Bible out the window and say, well, my opponent doesn't believe in the Bible and my audience doesn't, so I shouldn't throw it out there. It's still, regardless of what our Ivy League schools think, it's still the most respected book in the history of mankind. And so you could use it as part of your argument and say, well, a lot of people reject the scriptures, but it formed the basis for our experience of freedom here in the West, and the scriptures teach this, and a lot of people still respect that. Now, for those who don't accept the authority of the scriptures, and then you might want to give medical reasons or things of that sort. So cultural apologetics is not the same as political action. It seeks to transform minds and hearts, knowing that if the minds and the hearts are transformed, it's going to lead people to make better decisions, and then eventually it's going to affect in the voting booth. Although I have to be honest with you, sometimes our choices are, you know, stinky, stinkier, and stinkier. So voting can only do so much. But it doesn't focus on changing leaders and laws. Political action is still needed, but without cultural apologetics, there will be no lasting improvement. If people think like socialists, and you get a few true freedom-loving constitutional politicians in power, if the people still think like socialists, they probably won't reelect those guys and gals next time around anyway, assuming there's going to be enough of them to make a difference. So time is running out for America. Our ungodly attitudes are causing the collapse of our country. Just changing leaders, changing laws, but continuing to reject God, to reject the gospel, and to be incredibly selfish and ungodly, and we think we're going to solve the problem? Okay? You know what's wrong with America? The hearts of Americans. That's what's wrong with America. Again, I am not saying, don't leave here and say, that's it, I'm not going to be politically active anymore. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, before you deal with these branches and these leaves, let's get the roots taken care of. Let's start putting some emphasis on that. Even if God does not choose to spare our nation, cultural apologetics will still serve several purposes. It will warn our culture to repent. Okay? And because in the end, what's more important than America surviving is that our friends live eternally in the presence of the Lord Jesus Christ. So it will warn our culture to repent, and it will show the real reason for America's collapse, our culture's rejection of God. We have to educate people. You know, that's like with all these financial problems we're having. You know what a lot of people are saying, what the media is saying? Well, that shows that capitalism has problems. Well, yeah, you know, free enterprise has a lot of problems when you blend it with a whole lot of socialism. But they're acting like, well, this proves capitalism doesn't work. Now we need more government. Well, that's what got us in the problem in the first place. St. Augustine's City of God was one of the greatest works on cultural apologetics. He argued that the fall of Rome was not Christianity's fault. Pagan Rome starts embracing Christianity. You know, Emperor Constantine, just a generation earlier, becomes a Christian. And now all of a sudden, the Roman Empire is becoming Christian, moving towards Christianity, and everything starts falling apart. And so the pagans were saying, see what you get for rejecting our pagan gods? And so he had to do cultural apologetics. Now, unfortunately for, you know, us dumbed down Americans, you know, the city of God is like this. I mean, you might as well read the Encyclopedia Britannica in your free time. So thankfully, somebody abridged it. I think it was Vernon Bork, I believe, abridged it to like 805 pages. So that'll keep me busy for the next 10 years. The example, I'm just going to rush through this. The example set by two 20th century cultural apologists, C.S. Lewis and Francis Schaeffer, I think largely their messages went unheeded. But I think there's a restraining power in the preaching and the defending of the faith. And so I think as bad as things are, it'd be worse if it wasn't for those two guys. Atheist Friedrich Nietzsche rightly diagnosed the problem. He didn't see it as a problem, but he rightly diagnosed it. But only Christian thinkers could offer the solution. And I've got a chapter in my book, The Death of Western Western Civilization. I think I wrote that around 2000. It was a paper I presented at a meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society. So I've been preaching that persecution is coming for quite a long time. So 300 years from now, if it comes down, then I'll sound pretty smart. But no, whatever the case, Nietzsche died in 1900. There's the big stash. He said, if God is dead, then truth is dead, morality is dead, and meaning is dead. Okay? He didn't believe that God was alive and then he had a heart attack and died. He believed that when he said God is dead, what that means is that Christianity was no longer the driving force of Western civilization. So in other words, he meant the same thing that Francis Schaeffer meant by saying that we live in a post-Christian era. Okay? And so he said, well, if Christianity is dead, then the Christian concept of truth is dead as well. There's no absolute truth. The Christian concept of morality is dead, and meaning in life is dead. But he acknowledged that man needs all those things. Now, he used to chastise his atheist buddies. He said, you guys are right in throwing God off the bridge, but you were wrong to go through his pockets and say, oh, morality, we need that. Oh, truth, we need that. Oh, meaning, we need that. Okay, now let's throw him off the bridge. So Nietzsche was more consistent than them. He said that when we throw God off the bridge, all this goes with him. Now, we desperately need those things. So Nietzsche says that we need a group of supermen to arrive on the scene with the courage through their will to power, because that's all that's left. When reason's thrown out the window, there's nothing left but power. Through their will to power, to invent, to create a new concept of truth, a new concept of morality, a new concept of meaning, and then to force that on the masses. He knew that it would be bloody. He glorified war and predicted the 20th century would be the bloodiest century in the history of mankind, and it was. Now, C.S. Lewis, being a Christian, was able to take that kind of thinking without even mentioning Nietzsche in his work, The Abolition of Man, and take it a step further. I recommend The Abolition of Man. I think it should be required reading for all Christians if I were an absolute dictator. But Lewis critiqued a 1940s English textbook. It was designed for grammar school children. The authors rejected absolute truth and morality. And so Lewis argued that if this view, rejecting absolute truth and morality, kind of like what's going on in the emerging church, if that becomes more and more widespread, it's going to lead to the abolition of man, where men are going to be men without chests, men without consciences. Okay? And then the man molders, the conditioners of the new age, he refers to them as the man molders of the new age before we even coined the phrase the new age movement. But he wrote this in the 1940s. But he said education and science would serve the all-powerful state as the few control the billions. Okay? So in other words, education wouldn't try to educate. You would try to indoctrinate in political correctness to keep those in power in power. Science wouldn't really find truth. Lewis talked about the distinction between science and magic is such a small line, because both try to control nature, that once you throw God out the window, science starts becoming science fiction. So don't be surprised when you see atheist scientists and atheist philosophers talking about intelligent beings from other planets, seeding life on the planet Earth. They don't even realize it. They're bringing back ancient paganism. Okay? Francis Schaeffer died in 1984. He talked about that this is in the West. We're in a post-Christian era. And he talked about the death of man. He critiqued B.F. Skinner's work. Skinner was a behavioral scientist in his work Beyond Freedom and Human Dignity. He argued that man is controlled by his genes and his environment, and that there's no absolute truth in morality. And so then Skinner said, you know what? So my intellectual buddies, the intellectual elites, we should control the masses. Let's get beyond freedom and human dignity, and we need to bring about the best possible future. Let's do it by controlling, manipulating people genetically and controlling their environments in an all-powerful state. Well, Schaefer responded that in his a very small book, about 75 pages, called Back to Freedom and Human Dignity. And Schaefer argued that if all men are controlled by their genetic makeup and their environments, then so are Skinner and his intellectual elite colleagues. They're no smarter than us. They're in the box with us. Okay? And then Schaefer also pointed out that if there is no such thing as good and evil, then there is no there's no such thing as good, better, or best direction in which to lead mankind. So if you throw out the concept of good, how can you say that? How could Skinner say that he and his buddies are going to bring about a better world? Unfortunately, B.F. Skinner's theories are being implemented in the United Nations UNESCO program, and even here in America, in programs such as Outcome-Based Education, America 2000, Goals 2000. Yeah, they usually change the names of these programs as time goes on and all, but it's the same type of thinking. And B.F. Skinner's views teach humans, they treat humans as if they're dogs. Okay? You give a dog a cookie and the light goes off, eventually when the light goes off, the dog will salivate and think he's going to get a cookie. You know, you could just control the behavior of the dog. Well, humans are not dogs. Unfortunately, it's hard to defend that view. Just read the writings of Peter Singer, the father of the animal rights movement, an ethicist teaching in Princeton. He says that the life of a full-grown chimpanzee or pig is worth more than the life of a newborn baby because they have a higher level of consciousness. See, what's happened is when you take God out of the picture, if God dies, man dies too. We live in a culture that has trashed God. And the only way we can prevent the culture from trashing man is to bring God back into the picture. And we're not going to be able to do that through political action alone. It's going to take cultural apologetics. Is it going to happen? Are we going to turn it around? If we turn around, it's going to be because of the miracle working power of God. But I think we should do it just because it's the right thing to do. Now, the guy who's speaking in here next is a really great guy, good friend of mine. Really like the guy. Appreciate his ministry. So I'm going to just cut it right there. If you have any questions, you can see me at the table later. That's the final question. Who will be the cultural apologist of the 21st century?